Shalom Aleichem, sweetest friends. This year should be a special chus for Abner Amrad Shichliu. It's chus chayich habifege bas Michal Yudisbasya, and it's based on an article by the great Gaon Rav Gleich Shlita, and hopefully we will talk about it more in future shiurim, but I thought this would be a great place to start. And the topic is the famous Get of Tzfas on March 3rd, 2014. The Beis Din of Tzfat announced a ruling sanctioning the giving of a get on behalf of a husband categorized by the Beis Din as a shoyte. The decision is quite lengthy due to copious citations of sources that may or may not substantiate the claim that they want to make. The Beis Din forthrightly described their decision as a chidush gadol. That's an understatement. Besides relying upon an amalgam of different strongly contested halachic determinations, the situation addressed hardly represents a case of first impression. Sadly, over the span of centuries, there have been many cases of husbands who have suffered from mental illness, rendering normal marital life impossible, and oftentimes requiring lifelong institutionalization. There is no hint in the voluminous rabbinic literature devoted to the vexing guna problems that any halachic authority entertained the possibility of divorce in a situation involving a mentally incompetent husband. Indeed, the Gemara in Gittin on Daf Ayin Amud Beis explicitly discusses the situation of a husband who directed that a divorce be arranged on behalf of his wife, but who became mentally incompetent before his wish could be honored. The Gemara declares that despite the husband's unequivocally announced intention, the get cannot be executed. The unequivocal declaration of the Mishnah Yevamos 112b, stating that a husband who becomes either cheresh or a shoyte subsequent to his marriage can never divorce his wife, lo yotzia olamis, certainly implies not only that a shoyte cannot execute a divorce, but also that a divorce cannot be executed on his behalf under any circumstances. Of all circumstances giving rise to an aguna situation, the case of a mentally incompetent husband is both the most tragic and most intractable. Husbands who go to war and fail to return, or who journey to distant locales and are not heard from subsequently, or who otherwise disappear, may often be presumed to have died. The problem lies in obtaining halakhically sufficient evidence of their demise. Such problems involve evidentiary matters lending themselves to a resolution in one manner or another. The difficulty is often formidable but not necessarily insurmountable, particularly since establishing widowhood is one of the few areas of halacha in which certain forms of circumstantial evidence are acceptable. The problem of a husband who has abandoned his wife and relocated to a geographically distant area, or a brother-in-law is unavailable to release the childless widow from yibum obligations, has virtually disappeared in an age of ready, available, and affordable jet travel. With perseverance and persuasive skill, not to speak of material inducement, the problem of a recalcitrant husband can in many cases be resolved. A solution for the problem that arises in a situation in which the husband has taken measures to divorce his wife by appointing an agent for that purpose, but in which the agent becomes incapable of discharging his duties, or B, a situation in which a get is actually drafted at the husband's behest, but the get is later found to be technically defective, is the subject of many learned responsa. In such instances, the husband is halachically competent and his desires are known. The problems involve technicalities of halacha that may or may not be surmountable. But the problem of a husband who has become mentally incompetent is a problem of a different magnitude. The problem is neither one of evidence nor of intention. Only the husband can initiate the drafting and subsequent delivery of a get. A mentally incompetent husband lacks capacity to execute a divorce. The result is tragic. The wife remains married throughout the lifetime of her husband, but married to a husband who cannot provide even the most elemental benefits of a marital relationship. It must be stressed that the decision of the Beis Din of Tzfas is limited in scope. It has no application beyond the case of a husband who is both non-sentient and institutionalized. The ruling does nothing to ameliorate the seemingly intractable problem of the modern-day aguna. In particular, it should not be confused with the notion of the so-called get zikui heralded in some circles as a panacea for the resolution of that problem. The ruling issued by the Beis Din of Tzfas is predicated in part upon the nullification of the marriage based upon a finding that no woman would enter into a marriage were she to have known that her prospective husband would one day become mentally incompetent. If the Tzfas Beis Din is correct with regard to a husband who becomes a shoita, the same reasoning should apply to a case of a wife who becomes a shoita, i.e. the marriage should retroactively be nullified because no husband would enter into such a marriage were he to be aware of his wife's future mental incapacity. If so, a husband would be free to marry without a need for a heter mei rabbanim, i.e. a formal dispensation from the edict of Rabbeinu Gershom prohibiting plural marriage. Rav Shalom Mordechai Shodron, the Tshuvas HaMaharsham in the 7th volume, Simon Tzadi Hei, does indeed espouse that conclusion, not on the grounds set forth by the Beis Din, but on the grounds that the principle of Tov Lameit of Tandu, better to accept an unappealing spouse than to live alone, is inapplicable to the male. The fact that all other authorities insist upon a heter mei rabbanim in order to permit the remarriage of a husband of a woman who has become mentally incapacitated and do not entertain the possibility of a retroactive annulment of the marriage indicates that they are in disagreement with the position of the Maharsham and hence that of the Beis Din of Tzfat as well. Yet, other than for vague, anonymous allusions, the Beis Din cites only one senior dayan, Hagoyin Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg Zatzal, as supportive of their conclusion, as recorded in that somewhat anti-Semitic rag Haaretz on June 1st, 2014, Rav Goldberg has since issued a statement denying his concurrence and voicing his disagreement. Agav, just a personal story, there's a certain other issue, which I will not specify what it is, that a lot of people say, oh, Rav Zalman Nechemiah is behind it. He's in favor. So Lamaisa, I once called him up to ask him, because I was involved in a situation like that, where which required what Rav Zalman Nechemiah apparently gave his hiskama to, or it was asked for, and he said, no, I didn't. So that's that. So better just ask these people directly. A series of statements have been published over the signatures of highly respected rabbinic figures, too numerous to list, denouncing the decision in the harshest of terms. It is not at all surprising. Many Ketresim articles, lots have been written in the last eight or so years. It is not at all surprising that the ruling of the Beis Din of Tzfat was found to be unacceptable by universally recognized halachic scholars. The initial response was a sharp public statement signed by numerous prominent rabbinical figures opposing the ruling. This is in the Yated Ne'aman, on the 19th of Sivan, 5774, and other places. Their short but succinct statement was in the form of a mechamen emretzes, a vigorous protest, in which they described the ruling as based upon fictitious rationales, sfarais beduyois, d'chuyois mehalacha, rejected by halacha. That brief statement contains one substantive observation. If the reasoning of the Beis Din is correct, many of the agunos referred to in the Gemara and post-Gemara are permitted. If so, since those women are explicitly forbidden to remarry, all the sages of Israel for time immemorial stand in opposition to them, to the Beis Din. The statement concludes with a prayer for fulfillment of the prophecy, Shiva Shavtayach Kavarishayna. Among the critics, Rav Steinman, Rav Nissen Karelitz, Rav Moshe Sternbach, Rav Yitzchak Tovia Weiss, the head of the Eidah Haredis. A more detailed letter authored by Rav Moshe Mordechai Farbstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevroni Yeshiva, outlining the principal objections to the Tzfas ruling, was forwarded to the Beis Din of Tzfas. He's great. Rav Farbstein's Torah is great. Appended to Rav Farbstein's letter is an endorsement by Rav Ram Euerbach, the Rav Roshi of Tveria, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Later, a more extensive rebuttal dated on the 16th of Cheshvan, 5744, was circulated by Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the present Rav Roshi Asfaradi, and there's another article written by Rav Ram Sherman, a retired Dayan based in Ha'elyon, Leir Urim. The tragic situation addressed in this decision is indeed heartbreaking. A 34-year-old woman married in 2002, 5 years after the marriage, the husband suffered a trauma to his skull that caused severe cerebral damage, leaving him incapable of any form of communication. According to newspaper reports, the injury was sustained in a motorcycle accident. I'm against riding motorcycles, for the record. During the ensuing seven-year period, there has been no improvement in his condition, and the medical specialist consulted agree that none can be contemplated. The Beisdin correctly notes that the category of shoita includes only persons suffering from, not only persons suffering from mental disorders and severe developmental retardation, but also persons lacking at least minimal cognitive function. A person in a permanent vegetative state, PVS, is certainly a shoita. The Beisdin decision is equivocal and even contradictory with regard to whether the patient in question is in a permanent vegetative state, having no awareness of himself or of his surroundings, or whether he is in a locked-in condition, i.e., a person who has an awareness of his surroundings and possibly even a very high level of cognitive function, but is incapable of communicating his thoughts, perceptions, or desires in any way. The persistent vegetative state must be distinguished from the locked-in syndrome, in which both the level and content of consciousness may be fairly normal, but the patient is severely paralyzed and hence appears to have diminished consciousness. In the locked-in state, vertical eye movements and eyelid blinking are intact. PET scanning has shown significantly higher metabolic levels in brains of patients in a locked-in state compared to patients in a vegetative state. In the situation addressed by the Beisdin of Tzfat, it is probably the case that these physicians were unable to determine whether the patient is in a permanent vegetative state or in a locked-in condition. The Beisdin conflates the two conditions in categorizing the patient as a shaita. There is, however, a significant distinction between the two. A person in a permanent vegetative state, like a deranged shaita, lacks capacity to either give or withhold consent to any act carried out in his name. A person in a locked-in state may indeed have mental capacity as well as firm desires, but is simply incapable of communicating his wishes to others. In assessing each of the considerations advanced by the Beisdin, it's necessary to determine whether the particular consideration is operative in either of those states or in both. Ostensibly, the Beisdin of Tzfas develops two separate arguments permitting the wife to remarry. Number one, the marriage is retroactively nullified because no woman would knowingly enter into a marriage in which the husband was destined to be afflicted in such a manner. And number two, in light of the tragic circumstances, the Beisdin may itself undertake the execution of the get on behalf of the husband. The determination of the Beisdin that in such circumstances a get may be executed on behalf of the husband is grounded upon assumption of two separate halachic principles. Number one, the Beisdin relies upon an expansive notion of the principle of sechiyah, or self-designated agency. Principles formulated in the context of acquiring property on behalf of another person without the beneficiary's directive or knowledge. The Talmudic formulation, zaken la'adam, property may be acquired for another person. Self-designated agency for divestiture of property is a different matter. For example, chametz is in the possession of a Jew on Erev Pesach acquires the status of a suvei hanot. Since he cannot subsequently use or smell the chametz, a person who has not previously disposed of his chametz or designated an agent to do so on his behalf will imminently suffer total loss of its value. Can a third party assume the prerogative of selling the owner's chametz to a non-Jew in the final moments before the chametz becomes prohibited? In usual circumstances, a person may not want to be deprived of the benefit of any property owned by him, even though he is generously compensated for that loss. However, in the case of chametz and Erev Pesach, total loss of the use and value of the object is imminent. Under such circumstances, whatever is received from the non-Jewish purchaser is found money, and sale of chametz immediately before it becomes devoid of value represents an unmitigated benefit. In such circumstances, does the principle of zechiyah also permit zachen mei adam, acquiring title from a person? That issue is a matter of significant controversy. Number two, the Beisdin asserts that when the husband is mentally incompetent, divorce, in at least some circumstances, constitutes an unmitigated benefit to him. Ostensibly, release of a wife from marital bonds represents an act of zaken mei adam, requiring the capacity to remarry from the husband rather than an act on behalf of the husband. The opinion of the Beis Din of Tzfas is largely devoted to substantiating its position with regard to each of these issues. Of course, it can be conclusively demonstrated that the marriage is void. If it can be conclusively demonstrated that the marriage is void, a get is unnecessary, and there is no need for further discussion. If that conclusion cannot be reached with certainty, affirmative resolution of the second question depends upon an antecedent determination that, even if the marriage of a person who becomes a shote cannot be declared with certainty to be null and void, nevertheless the wife cannot be declared with certainty to be married. Rather, she has the status of a suffocatious ish. The importance of that point is that the Beis Din was willing to consider the divorce to be a zchus gamur, or an absolute benefit, for the incapacitated husband, only because of the consideration that, when the marital state is doubtful, the husband cannot assert various marital rights and prerogatives that accrue to him by virtue of that marital relationship. Thus, unless it can be established that under the circumstances of later the marriage is at best of doubtful validity, the entire argument fails. Rabbi Feinstein criticizes the Beis Din for purporting to advance two independent grounds for releasing the woman from marital bonds, whereas in reality they propound but a single disjunctive argument, i.e., either she is not married and no get is necessary, or if she is indeed married, a get may be executed on the basis of zechiyah. That criticism misses the mark. The Beis Din is in effect advancing a bifurcated argument in order to establish separate grounds for remarriage, i.e., either the woman's status is that of an unattached female, or if she is married, the get executed on the basis of zechiyah serves to terminate the marriage. Thus, the formal structure of the argument is actually that of a sveik sveika. But at the same time, Rav Feinstein's criticism is understated, since even the second argument collapses under the validity of the marriage, unless the validity of the marriage is subject to halachically cogent challenge. So what are the grounds for this decision? The In Gemara in Baba Kama 110b questions whether a woman whose husband dies without issue is released from Yibum obligations in a situation in which her sole brother-in-law is a mukeshchin, i.e. is afflicted with a repugnant dermatological condition that renders intercourse loathsome, on the grounds that, had the widow known while yet a bride the fate she would suffer upon the demise of her husband, she would not have entered into the marriage. If she would not have assented to the marriage, the effect would be retroactive nullification of the marriage, and consequently, obviation of Yibum obligations. The Gemara's response is that it cannot necessarily be presumed that no woman would enter into a marriage if such a fate were foreknown to her, despite the consequences. Tov lemeit of tandum lemeit of am, better to live as a couple than to live alone, I wouldn't prefer any marriage to spinsterhood. The Gemara's reasoning is somewhat obscure. Halacha recognizes the validity of conditional marriage, but ordinarily a condition must be expressly stipulated. Such stipulations must be formulated in a formally prescribed manner. If not expressed in the prescribed manner, the condition fails, and the act to which it is attached is rendered absolute. Mental reservations are not given legal cognizance. If so, the Gemara's tentative assertion that the marriage of a woman who later becomes subject to a levirate marriage to Yibum, in which her prospective partner is a mukeshchin, should be void ab initio does not seem to be cogent. Granted that the bride would not have wished to predicate her assent to the marriage upon a condition subsequent that would have the effect of nullifying the marriage retroactively should such an eventuality arise, nevertheless, in point of fact, she did not do so. Even had the thought to do so occurred to her, an unexpressed condition is of no halachic effect. The reasoning underlying the Gemara's conclusion is elucidated by the Beis Halevi, Chelek Gimel, Simen Gimel. He quotes the Gemara in Kedushin, explaining that an umdana demuchach, an intention or reservation that is obvious to all, need not be formally stipulated or verbally expressed, because on Ansade we are witness to the fact that such a stipulation would be desired by every person in a comparable situation. Dvarim shebelev kol adam, in the heart of every person, are tantamount to an oral declaration. That concept is somewhat akin to the notion of judicial notice in the sense that no actual evidence is required. Indeed, the person presumed to be making the stipulation need not do so even mentally. The need for such a stipulation need not even occur to him. The presumed stipulation is constructive in nature. The Gemara attentively assumes that all brides constructively desire a stipulation that would serve retroactively to nullify the marriage in face of yibum to a mukesh shchin. That presumption is negated only by virtue of the principle tav lemeitu of tandu milameit of arm. However, if the presumed stipulation is not one that would be universally desired by all persons finding themselves in comparable circumstances, a condition in pectoris is of no effect. That explains Beis Halevi is the thrust of the Gemara's invocation of Tav Lemeitav Tandu in dismissing the possibility of retroactive nullification of the marriage. Tav Lemeitav Tandu is invoked in order to establish that it is not universally understood that a woman would not entertain the possibility of a levirate relationship with a brother-in-law who is in Mukushchin. Such an assumption is unwarranted if there are at least some women willing to accept such a contingency. Hence, in invoking the principle of Tav Lemeitav Tandu with regard to Mukushchin, the Gemara should not be understood as declaring that every woman would find marriage, even to a mukashchin, preferable to spinsterhood. The Gemara seeks only to establish that some women would accept such a marriage rather than remain single. Thus, the Gemara's assertion, Tav Lemeitav Tandu, serves simply to establish the crucial point that in any particular case, we cannot serve as witnesses to an unexpressed stipulation that would have the effect of retroactively invalidating the marriage. The Beis Din of Tzfas, in a huge argumentative leap, proceeds to declare that in the case before it involving a woman who had become an aguna for 7 years and who remained an aguna for additional years without limit, quote-unquote, such future harm, quote-unquote, overpowers the benefit of the period of limited years of marriage that the woman managed to live with her husband before he suffered a trauma. The Beis Din asserts that no woman would enter into such a marriage in return for the benefits enjoyed during the early years of marriage. The Beis Din concludes, without further ado, that in such circumstances there exists an umdana regarding a condition at the time of the nisuin, despite the absence of explicit articulation of the condition, and despite the fact that they did not consider the condition at the time of the marriage. The Gemara entertains the suggestion that occurrence of yibum obligations vis-à-vis a mukashchin might serve retroactively to another marriage on grounds of error, but makes no such suggestion with regard to a marriage in which the husband himself later becomes a mukashchin. Quite evidently, the Gemara assumes that the parties are aware of and willing to accept such a contingency, but are not so sanguine with regard to the more remote possibility of yibum involving a mukashchin, as between the parties themselves, the marriage is entered, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health. The Beis Din fails to explain how the situation of a wife whose husband is assessed as being in a permanent vegetative state is different than that of a woman whose husband becomes a mukashchin on the morrow of their wedding. The Beis Din does not suggest that in the latter case, the marriage might be retroactively dissolved on the basis of mistake. Although, unlike with regard to a husband who becomes a mukashchin, there could be no further spousal companionship whatsoever with a patient in a vegetative state, a wife whose husband suffers from an unfortunate loss of mental capacity after 5 years of marriage has certainly experienced the benefits of marriage over a much longer period of time, and it cannot be stated that no woman would enter into such a marriage. There is a fundamental question regarding whether at least some women are prepared to accept any and all defects in a life partner, or whether some contingencies are so onerous that no woman would enter into a marriage were she to be aware of the fate in store for her. The Mordechai and Yevamos, Simon Chavtes, cites a response dating from the Gaonic period to the effect that the wife of a man whose sole brother is an apostate is putter from Yibum on the grounds that in such circumstances the marriage is retroactively nullified. The Maram of Rotenburg, cited by the Mordechai, justifies the position of the Gona by citing the comment of the Gemara that some women prefer koldehu, a minimal marriage to a mukashchin, in preference to spinsterhood. Maram of Rotenburg argues that the term koldehu is the key phrase. Everyone would insist that at least some type of relationship with her spouse would insist upon at least some type of relationship with your spouse, even if it is only minimal in nature. Marriage to an apostate, asserts the Maharam, is far more onerous than a marriage to a mukashchin, because it does not rise to the level of even a minimal relationship. The Mordechai concludes with a comment that, anan sade, to the fact that no one would submit to such a relationship, because perforce the brother-in-law will force her to commit serious averas. Since the wife will insist upon a separation, she will not enjoy even the most minimal of spousal relations. And Mordechai concludes with the report that Rashi, in one of his responses, disagreed with the position later formulated by Maharam, and furthermore, that the Maharam himself wasn't prepared in practice to rule contrary to Rashi. Rashi is quoted by the Tur, Neben Ezer 157. Rashi seemingly maintained that the principle expressed by the Gemara applies to all possible contingencies, including those in which even a minimal relationship is impossible. However, Rabbi David HaKohen of Corfu in Shubas Radach Bias 9, Cheder Shesh, opines that Rashi disagreed only because, unlike the Goyim, he maintained that the widow can experience a marital relationship with at least a minimal quality, even with an apostate who is available for Yivam, but would agree that if, for example, the apostate has absconded with the result that she has no prospect of any type of companionship, she would not have entered into a marriage that would ultimately leave her an aguna. According to that analysis of Rashi's position, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and the Tshuvas HaTzvi and Eben Ezer, Tzadi Tes, Kuf Chav Gimel, and Reish Aleph, argues that according to the Tshuvas HaRadach, Rashi would concede that there are no Yibam obligations in the case of brother-in-law who is mentally incompetent, since it is not possible to live in a marital relationship with a Shait and Hartzvi. Eben Ezer, number 201, where Frank extends that reasoning to a situation in which the brother-in-law is married, lives in a jurisdiction in which polygamy is a criminal offense, and does not have the power to divorce his wife. Hartzvi assumes that the reason that a woman would not entertain a marriage that would give rise to Yibum vis-a-vis an apostate is that an apostate is likely to refuse to marry her and also refuse to release her from Yibum obligations by means of Chalitza. That reasoning, he argues, applies mutatis mutandis in the case of a Shote. However, Moshe Feinstein in the Yerushalmi Moshe Eben Ezer, Chelek Aleph, 162, takes issue with the Hartzvi, on the grounds that the reason a woman would not enter into a marriage that results in Yibam obligations vis-a-vis an apostate is not her fear of remaining in Aguna, but precisely the opposite, the fear that, as noted earlier, she would be forced to marry the apostate who would then compel her to engage in severe transgressions. Thus, it is the fear of duress to commit severe transgressions rather than the prospect of becoming an aguna that retroactively invalidates the marriage. Hence, according to the Igros Moshe, the case of the brother-in-law is a shaita cannot be equated to that of brother-in-law was a mishumid, was a mummer. The shaita cannot enter into a marriage, and accordingly, although the widow remain an aguna, she will not be subject to transgression under duress. The Igros Moshe's analysis reflects what appears to be the understanding of the Tshuvas Maimonios and Seder Nashim Simon Choftes. However, in contradistinction to the Igros Moshe, Tshuvas Radach understands Tshuvas Maimonides' positions in the manner of the Hartzvi. Similarly, Beis Yosef, Eben Ezer 140, asserts that according to Rashi, absent the principle Tov L'Meitav Tanu L'Meitav Ramlu, the wife would not have entered into the original marriage had she known that she was destined eventually to become the after to Yibam with a Mukah Shechin. If so, Rashi also agrees that the marriage to be valid, even the prospective Yibam relationship, must be at least minimal in nature. Hence, even disagreeing with the Goyim, Rashi would concede that the prospect of Yibam with the Shota, with whom there cannot be even a minimal relationship, would render the marriage a nullity ab initio. According to the Beis Yosef, averts that Rashi, who maintains that the original marriage is not nullified in the case of a mumer brother-in-law, rules that in that manner only because he maintains that a woman prefers even marriage to an apostate over remaining forever single. The marriage ceremony is separated into two distinct components, Erusin and Nisuin, which may or may not take place on separate occasions. Erusin serves to create a relationship between the parties as a result of which the wife loses capacity to contract a marriage with another male. Nisuin occurs upon the bride entering into the husband's abode, even if only symbolically, and serves to give rise to reciprocal rights, privileges, duties, and prerogatives of the marital relationship. Unlike the contemporary practice of combining both aspects of the marriage in a single ritual, in earlier epochs, a significant period of time was allowed to intervene between the Erusin and the Nisuin. Tos Bava Kamma 110b, Divrei Maschil. Da'adaita da'achi. Indicate that the Gemara does not at all question Yibam obligation in a situation in which the husband dies without issue subsequent to Nisuin and his brother is a Mukashchin. Tos declares that the query regarding retroactive annulment is limited to a situation in which the husband dies during the period of Erusin. The distinction lies in the fact that a bride enjoys none of the benefits and prerogatives of the marital state while yet an Arusa. Only after Nisuin she was endowed with claims for a conjugal gratification and entitled to support and maintenance, etc. Tos maintained that the Gemara was perfectly satisfied to assume that a woman entering into Nisuin assumes all risks with regard to future contingencies because that is part of the bargain negotiated by the parties. The wife accepts attendant risks in return for tangible benefits. Such a situation is analogous to a commercial transaction involving the purchase of an object that subsequently develops a defect, severely diminishing its value. Future defects are accepted as part of the bargain. Erusin is different solely because the wife renders her capacity to contract any other marriage, but receives no benefit in return. She then has nothing to lose by imposing conditions, and conversely, the husband has no bargaining power that might bolster his refusal to accept such conditions. Accordingly, only in circumstances in which there is no benefit to the bride can it be thought that she would not have accepted the risk of yibam with a mukashchin. This is reason that it cannot be assumed that a woman would insist upon such a condition at the time of Nisuin, since refusal of the husband to accept such a condition would entail her loss of the benefits of Nisuin. Thus it follows that, according to Tosfos, there is no reason at all to question the validity of Nisun in a case in which the husband subsequently becomes a Shoita, since the bride perforce accepts all future contingencies as part of the bargain from which she receives significant benefit. The Beis Din apparently recognized that the principle of Tav Lameit of Tandu renders its conclusion tenuous. To obviate that consideration, the Beis Din is forced to rely upon sources that maintain that Tav Lameit of Tandu does not apply to a Shaita, a matter that, as earlier noted in recent years, involves a dispute between Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Moshe Feinstein. Moreover, the Beis Din does not directly address the principal position of Tosfos, who maintain that the entire discussion of the Gemara pertains to an Arusa, and that due to the benefits received by the wife in a full-fledged marital relationship, the notion of nullification of Nisuin is not even a matter of consideration in the Gemara's discussion. Nor does the Beis Din recognize the nullification of a marriage by virtue of an implied condition is limited to situations that may arise with regard to future levirate marriage, as distinct from contingencies that may arrive in the course of the original marriage. In order to overcome those flaws in their argument, the Beis Din engages in an unprecedented extension of the possibility of retroactive nullification of a marriage. The Beis Din seeks to establish both that such nullification is possible even after consummation of a marriage in Nisuin, and that retroactive nullification occurs even in situations in which the husband himself later becomes a Shaita. In order to establish the second point, the Beis Din seeks to establish that the principle Tav Lameit of Tandu does not apply to a Shota, because no one would accept a Shota as a life partner, even if the alternative would be spinsterhood. The Beis Din endeavors to establish that there do exist authorities who entertain retroactive nullification of a marriage, even subsequent to Nisuin. The Beis Din asserts that Tosfos Ksubis, Mizan Odei, Diyuvasu Shalom, in disagreement with Tosfos Bava Kamma, do definitively state that retroactive nullification may take place even subsequent to Nisuin. Tosfos Ksubis, Mizan Odei's remark that the Gemara speaks of a woman who becomes a widow and his brother-in-law as a mukashchim but ignores the more obvious and more likely case of a husband who himself becomes a mukashchin. Tosfos responded that there was no reason to entertain the cogency of a condition subsequent that might invalidate the marriage on the basis of the defect later developed by the husband. Tosfos declared that although a bride would certainly welcome a stipulation invalidating the marriage under such circumstances, there is no reason to assume the husband would agree. Contractual stipulations are invalid unless accepted by both parties. and the husband has no reason to acquiesce in a stipulation made solely for the benefit of the wife. However, can see Tosfos, the Gemara does entertain nullification of the marriage in face of impending Yibum to a Mugashkin on the grounds that the husband would assuredly agree to a stipulation annulling the marriage retroactively if he dies without issue and his brother is a Mugashkin, because the husband, quote-unquote, is not concerned with what happens after his death. The Tzfas Beis Din proceeds to conclude that a husband who becomes the functional equivalent of a vegetable with no awareness of his surroundings is similarly unconcerned with whether or not his marriage is nullified. Again, that conclusion does not withstand scrutiny. On what basis do Tosfos assert that the husband is unconcerned with retroactive nullification of his marriage upon his demise? The result of nullification of a marriage is that all acts of coitus during the course of the marriage are retroactively rendered acts of znus. That result is explicitly recognized by the Gemara Yevamos 110a, Gittin 33a, in cases in which marriage is nullified as a result of violation of a rabbinic edict. There is also a presumption expressed by the Gemara numerous times, Yevamos 107a, Ksuba 73a, Gittin 81b, that no male engages in znus if the sexual act might be rendered permitted by its performance as a consummation of a marriage. Moreover, as previously noted, Tosfos' reasoning is contradicted by Tosfos' own statement in Bava Kamma 110b to the effect that the Gemara has no need to assert the principle Tav Lameit of Tandu in the case of Nisun, because even absent that consideration, the wife perforce must accept such a contingency in return for marital benefits. However, as Tosfos state in their comments to Ksubas 47b, if the husband is entirely unconcerned with regard to what transpires after his death, why should he object to such a condition in the case of Nisuin? Nevertheless, it appears that the apparently conflicting statements of Tosfos Bava Kamma 110b and Ksubas 47b can be reconciled. The statement of Tosfos and Ksubas should be understood as reflecting a thesis developed by Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinz in the Or Samech, Malachim 4:4, and in a contribution to Ein Tanai B'Nisuin. The Rambam, Malachim 4:4, rules that Pilakshus is forbidden to all persons other than a monarch. The exclusion of the monarch from the prohibition banning concubinage is difficult to comprehend. A king is subject to all biblical commandments. The Rambam, Ishus 1:4, regards the commandment, "There shall be no harlot among the children of Israel," as prohibiting intercourse outside the marital relationship. Concubinage is regarded by Rambam as forbidden because it constitutes a form of extramarital intercourse. Why then is a monarch permitted to take a concubine? Or Samech assumes that Rambam understands extramarital sexual acts to be forbidden because they are, by their nature, promiscuous. An unmarried woman who engages in such an act is not in a monandrous relationship. No marital constraints prevent her from having multiple sexual partners. Relationships that allow for promiscuity are defined by the Rambam as harlotry, znus. Promiscuity is not a legitimate option for a king. However, the Rambam, Malachim 4:4, rules that a king's consort is forbidden to all other men throughout the lifetime of the king, just as use of his scepter, etc., is forbidden to all others. Even after the king, after the death of her consort, the king's concubine is permitted only to another king. The result is that the king's concubine cannot licitly be promiscuous, because no other male may enjoy her sexual favorites, just as no other person may enjoy use of objects such as a scepter previously used by a king. Since the consort of a monarch is forbidden to all others during his lifetime, the relationship cannot be promiscuous. Hence, it does not constitute harlotry. Accordingly, says the Or Samech, since upon becoming a concubine of the king, the concubine may cohabit with anyone else, she is permitted, may not cohabit with anyone else, she is permitted to the king. Ramban, Ebn Ezer 26:1, cites and apparently agrees with the early day authorities who rule that Pilakshus is Aser. Yet the Ramban, Ebn Ezer 157:4, rules that conditional marriage in a form of a stipulation to the effect that the marriage is retroactively nullified if the husband dies without issue is entirely acceptable. The purpose of a condition of that nature is to avoid situations that give rise to Yibam. But essentially, such a stipulation should be forbidden because its effect is to retroactively nullify the marriage and thereby render all acts of coitus acts of fornication. If so, why is the condition subsequent not forbidden? Because it creates a possibility that the relationship will resolve itself into a state of concubinage The answer, says the Or Samech, is that the condition in question is unique. The Or Samech observes that a condition nullifying the marriage in the event that the husband dies without issue is a singular in nature, and that fulfillment or non-fulfillment of the condition cannot be determined unless and until the husband dies without surviving issue. As a result, the wife is prohibited from engaging in intercourse with any other man during the lifetime of her husband. So long as the husband is alive, there is no way to determine with certainty that the husband will die without issue. Hence, every extramarital act is forbidden to the wife as a possible act of adultery, with the result that she is constrained to a monandry. If the husband does die without issue and the marriage is nullified, the wife's status is retroactively that of a concubine. However, concludes Rav Meir Simcha, such concubinage, since perforce who is constrained to be monogamous, is comparable to the permissible concubinage of a monarch. Very good, Or Samech. He needs my scum. The comments of Tosfos 47b may be understood in precisely the same manner. As in the case described by our mother, the husband has no concern, quote-unquote, with regard to retroactive fornication in situations in which his marriage is nullified only upon his death, because so long as he is alive, the relationship is one of legitimate monogamous concubinage. It is also true that, assuming the marriage is retroactively nullified in the event that the husband does become a shaita, no woman would be permitted to engage in extramarital cohabitation unless and until her husband actually becomes a shaita. If so, her status arguably is that of a permitted concubine. Nevertheless, the comparison drawn by the Bezin between the husband's lack of concern with regard to retroactive nullification of his marriage upon his death and a retroactive nullification of Kana's becoming a shota is inapt. Quite obviously, men are in no position to prevent their widows from remarrying. Hence, assert Tosfos, whether his wife remarries as a widow or as a technically heretofore never married woman is of no concern to him. The husband's sole concern is that there will be a monogamous relationship throughout the lifetime. His lifetime. If this analysis of Tosfos is correct, no comparison can possibly be drawn between retroactive nullification of marriage upon death of the husband and similar retroactive nullification upon the husband becoming a shaita. A husband cannot prevent his widow from remarrying. However, a husband who becomes a shaita is indeed in a position to prevent his wife from remarrying during his lifetime. No source is adduced by the Beis Din to justify extending a psychological presumption regarding postmortem equanimity to a lack of concern on the part of the husband for preserving a marital relationship when he is no longer mentally competent. There is no reason to assume that Tosfos would agree that a person contemplating becoming a shota would be sanguine in face of a situation in which his wife becomes another man's spouse while he, the shota, is still alive. Moreover, even accepting the literal reading of Tosfos espoused by the Tzfas Beis Din, in the instant case, there seems to be no empirical evidence that the husband is unaware of his surroundings, and hence there is no basis for ascribing to him, by way of analogy, the same lack of concern as might be ascribed to a corpse. Okay, so that is part one of this incredible analysis of the fascinating Get of Tzfas. And Amir Tzashem, in the next segment, we will continue and see more Niflos Mitaras Hashem. And I thank you so much for listening. Shalom, shalom, sweetest and most beloved.